Is it time to reimagine your future? The right business skills may make a difference in your career. At Capella University, we offer a relevant education that's designed to focus on what you need to know in the business world. We'll teach professional skills to help you pursue your goals, like business management, strategic planning, and effective communication. And you can apply these skills right away. A different future is closer than you think with Capella University. Learn more at capella.edu.
My dad works in B2B marketing. He came by my school for career day and said he was a big ROAS man. Then he told everyone how much he loved calculating his return on ad spend. My friends still laugh at me to this day.
Not everyone gets B2B, but with LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people who do. Get a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/campaign to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/campaign. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be. To be.
In this episode, Parag Amin, CFO at Dot Digital Group, shares his insights on how to build a compelling company narrative, the importance of thinking as an analyst versus an accountant, and what the pandemic recovery may look like across the world. Hey, I'm Ross, and this is the CFO Playbook. Each week, you'll get insights from world-class finance leaders to help you grow your company and yourself and face the challenges required of today's finance leaders. Welcome, Parag, and thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
So I'd like to start, actually, you've got a very interesting background and the journey is not one that you often see, which is where you've gone from the world of tier one investment banking, like various analyst roles, then into being a founder and then into being a CFO and not just any company, but a public company. So can you talk a little bit about how you charted that journey? Because it's quite a unique one.
When you work in, I suppose, the analyst role in an investment bank, you are, in simplistic terms, doing three things. You're modeling out company financials. So you have the numbers element. You're meeting, evaluating management teams, and then you're looking at business strategy. So ultimately, you're doing three things, particularly in terms of forecasting numbers, deciding on whether you believe management teams can succeed and execute on their plan, and then whether the plan can actually work based on the industry. Now, a lot of those skills are very transferable into management roles within businesses, in my view, because ultimately that's a lot of what a senior exec team needs to do themselves. So I've worked at the likes of Goldman Sachs and Citi and big investment banks, but I also had experience at some of the smaller UK mid-cap banks such as Peel Hunt and then Canaccord. And that gave me a kind of breadth of looking at technology companies from the very small, some very small UK technology companies all the way through up to large global, very large cap businesses, even back in the day, the likes of Nokia and Ericsson and ASML and others. So I've looked at a lot of different tech companies from an analyst perspective, met a lot of management teams, and therefore, obviously, when you're writing research, modeling out a lot of businesses. So the Dot Digital opportunity came along now just over 3 years ago, I suppose, because they were very, odd thing to say, but they were very accountant heavy. So, and I would also say that the board at the time, the likes of Frank Bichenor, who's now the CEO of Smartspace, and Pete Simmons, who's also on the likes of D4, T4, and Richard Keller-Clark, were forward-looking and quite exploratory in terms of the role that they saw for a CFO within a business. Because typically and traditionally, CFOs have been accountants and potentially wrongly so, but stereotyped as sort of bean counters. They were much more visionary in their thinking in the sense that they wanted someone at Dot Digital who could do more than just sort of the basic accounts, because there were enough accountants within the business already. They wanted someone who could forecast and look ahead, translate the numbers into something that was tangible for the Citi analysts, but also for the broader investment community. They wanted someone who could help the CEO strategically, but also be very data-driven, data-focused, data-heavy. But thirdly, also someone who knew the investment community, which, you know, with the number of places I've worked at and the time and the longevity, I probably am one step removed from most people in the city, which meant that I was able to help formulate the narrative around what the business was becoming. Because Dot Digital itself had grown up from being the sort of the dot mailer platform that it was known for in the UK as an email sends platform, to now becoming what we are today, which is a data-driven multi-channel marketing automation platform. And that journey is not always the easiest to explain to an investment community, because you're trying to change their mindset of what they believe the company is. Because having worked, you know, on the fund management side, the one thing you don't have a lot of is time. Because if you think about your investment pool, you could be investing in anything in the world. So there are thousands of companies that you're looking at. You don't get to spend days and days just evaluating one business. You're spending time looking at it very high level, looking at the overall financial metrics, comparing valuation versus other businesses. You get some input from the sell side, of course, but ultimately you focus on those companies you think are in the right space and have the right financial metrics and performance metrics. So the challenge at the time when I joined Dot Digital was to ensure that the financials were solid from an investment perspective, but that the story matched and the narrative matched what the business was looking to achieve over the next 3 years. And I'd like to say, touch wood, we've done a good job on that. One of the best performing shares in the UK market over that period, but we've still got a way to go. And so, you know, that skill set that I bring, I think, adds value, but it's evolving over time, and you've got to continue to make sure that you're up with the constant change in technology that we're delivering for our customers being translated into something tangible that the investment community can hang on to see why Dot Digital is a stock that you should be owning for the long term.
And I looked when I was researching Dot Digital and trying to understand the business a bit more, I was looking actually at the share price. And again, another technology company that's just had an incredible ride over the past 12, 15 months. And obviously in the old Steve Jobs adage, like, stocks can go down as well as up. We all know that it's an unpredictable market. You know that perhaps better than anyone else, but it's a clear demonstration of trust, which is impressive to see.
Yeah, and we have gone up and down with certain news flow. We've had, in my time, we've had the introduction of GDPR. It was a regulation that did change things for the industry to a large extent. We've navigated that well. We've obviously had the pandemic. That's when it first kicked in, everything was an unknown. Again, with the strong balance sheet we have and the cash flows we generate, we've navigated that well as well. But, you know, stocks, as you say, do go up and down, and we have those. But the long term, it's around making sure we have consistent, profitable growth with strong top line. And that, for me, has been the biggest challenge that we as Dot Digital face versus many of our competitors who are privately listed or other technology companies that don't necessarily have to have the same operating margin profile that we do, the same, let's say, even cash flow metrics, etc. So we're highly cash generative. We're, you know, strong EBITDA and operating margins. We're growing top line over 20% was the last reported number. And those are metrics that aren't easy to maintain, but that's what we're ultimately looking to continue to do. We're in a good space. Communication channels continue to increase. The volume of communication across digital channels will always continue to increase as well. So we're in a good space where, you know, we make sure we invest wisely back into the business and allows us to hit those performance metrics. But ultimately, yeah, being a public business, you're always having to make sure that you manage according to what the market expects.
And you spoke a bit about the story, and that's something that I've been personally involved in, whether it's Soldo or prior to that at Dropbox, is trying to tell that story, whether it's on a small part or part of a funding round or wherever. And I think that there's real artistry in being able to tell the right story. But as you said, the challenge, right, like for you, and you're doing it to like people who are investing publicly, but of course there are many CFOs and finance leaders who are doing it as part of a venture-backed journey. The challenge is, how do you communicate to that audience who are so time poor and who are naturally very analytical because they can get a truth from the numbers? So there's a bias towards the benchmarking. And you mentioned the three things, like the financial planning, the modeling, the team and the strategy. And the financial part, in some cases, that can be the dominant one because it's the most binary quantitative, and you can actually say, you can put someone on a scale and it's very definitive. But the team and the strategy is the arguably as important, if not in some cases more important, but it's much harder to judge. So how do you balance that tension up and tell the most compelling and effective story to that time poor audience?
Yeah, I mean, it always resonates back to my analyst days, where the front page, where you have probably three, maybe four short paragraphs to convey that story for people then to actually want to open the report, comes into it. Where, to your point, the financials, they're almost a byproduct to a large extent of the former two. Because if you have the right strategy in terms of your positioning within your market, your segment of that market, whatever that sort of niche may be within your industry. So for us, we are omnichannel marketing automation. So the first question I would ask as a potential investor into the business is, how fast is that industry growing? What is your market position in it? And what is the competitive landscape look like, right? Very, very simple question. So if you can address whether it's the TAM, and TAMs are always difficult, right? Your total addressable market, you can kind of make it whatever you want, but give some indication of what's left in that pie that you could potentially take. The second part is why you are positioned successfully against your peer group. And, you know, if you're a technology business, why your technology would stand out? Why would someone want to buy it? That gives you comfort in the business model. You've then got to have the second element, which is comfort in the management team and the leadership, to say, can they execute on what they're saying? If those two boxes are ticked, the financials almost become a byproduct, because you're ultimately saying, okay, let's say the market's growing at 20%. Well, if you believe that business is positioned well, has a product that is as good as, if not better than its peer group, can invest in sales and marketing to make sure that it's relevant, can continue to invest in the product, well, it should grow more than the market ultimately, because it should take share from weaker competitors. So you've almost got a natural, let's for argument's sake, say the market grows 20%. Your business will grow 20 to 25%. Could be higher, but that's your, and so, and then off there, you can base the rest of your financials. So to a large extent, if you can tick those first two boxes, the third just plays out. And you're right, a lot of people focus on the financials because it's easy to quantify, it is numbers, but it's easy to quantify what you're expecting. The first two are very qualitative. And yes, you can try and quantify the industry and the market. You know, we can look at, in my industry, for example, people talk about the TAM being 20 billion by 2027, or whatever the number Forrester comes up with. But it doesn't mean anything when you're at the moment, 60 million market, you know, revenue business growing at 20%. So it just means that there is a large market there to potentially take. But more importantly, it's, can we execute on that? And if we believe we can, then we should be growing faster than the market. And if the market in our case is said to be growing at 14%, then for us to achieve 15 to 20% should be doable. Ultimately, and that's the key. So I think focusing on the financials to begin with is almost the wrong way of looking at it. And I think that's the mistake often people make, because they're in financial position, they'll present the financials first, because that's their bread and butter, that's what they'll know well, that's the easy thing to present. It's a lot harder to present the investment case behind the business model and the management team. But those, for most investors, are probably more important than the numbers to a large extent, because the numbers should play out so long as you trust the first two.
And I think that Dot Digital is a very established company, so the numbers should be far more predictable on that basis. I guess when you actually move into earlier stage ventures, that investment thesis is arguably even more important again, because you won't have this reams and years of data to sell on.
Yeah, I mean, we're fortunate in our business model being a SaaS recurring revenue contracted model. So ultimately, whether Dot Digital was 10 million of revenue or 60 million of revenue, having 90% plus of your revenue being recurring, you're not going to be too far off at the end of the year in terms of your forecasting. But to your point, in terms of smaller businesses, absolutely, because you don't have any numbers to go off of. You could have your 3 and 5 year forecast, but a lot of them, and I remember this from my startup when I was raising money through angel investors, I could put 3 year figures, 5 year figures out there, but they're kind of finger in the air. And ultimately you're going to maximize them in order to show the potential to try and raise that funding. But what are they buying into? They're not buying into the numbers. They're buying into you as a founder. They're buying into the business model. And they're buying into the strategy. So if the investor in early stage companies is buying into that, it's just as imperative for larger companies. It's the same principle. So I think, as I say, the numbers typically play out as long as you are executing well within your market and your business is well positioned and you continue to invest in it. And I think that's key. So for anyone who's having to present to a board or in potential investors, for me, there's three things. Again, keep it simple. Focus on the big picture to begin with, because that sets the scene and sets the narrative. Then go into the detail and show them what's possible. Because if you do it in a different order, it comes across as though you're not as comfortable in that big picture. If the numbers aren't going to match, if the numbers are presented first, it's harder for them to match up to and marry up to the strategy and the bigger picture. So that, for me, that order has always worked. But ultimately, they are buying into you as a management team if they're investing.
It's funny when you mentioned TAM and that TAM can be anything you make it. I once made that mistake. I was presenting to a senior finance leader, and it was at Dropbox at the time, and we were talking about a big program, and we sold it on, okay, this is the TAM. And he was great about it, but he did say that, I don't like TAM because you just take a big number, you multiply it by another big number, and you get an even bigger number. And then he said, okay, so let's think about this differently. And we did, and we worked through it. But that always stuck with me, is that because the selling, of course, we're talking about now is trying to talk about a company vision externally to investors of some sort, whether it's public or growth investors. But I'm sure there are many people within Dot Digital who are actually coming to you to maybe sell a business case or an investment case and say, actually, this is what we want to do and this is why we want to do it. So, like, do you then apply the same principles in reverse? So to try and guide the team to say, listen, you can come to me with the business case, but let's talk about, you know, the concept and the big picture first.
Yeah, I probably shouldn't say this, but they did it that way, it'd be much more, it would resonate a lot more. So you're right. That is how I look at it. It's interesting you say that, because we have a junior end. So over the last month or so, all of our senior leadership team have presented to myself and Milan, the CEO, their plans for next financial year and the investment they would like. And yeah, some of them will start off with the detail first to say, this is the investment I need. If I get this investment, these are the numbers I'll hit. But others do it probably in more of the way I've kind of outlined, which is look at the opportunity here, look at the different geographical territories we could enter, look at the, within different departments, it could be areas of marketing spend that we could invest more into, or whatever that may be, more into products and in these areas. And then, okay, if we do this, this is what we could achieve. But in order to achieve this, we're going to need this level of investment. And if we do this, then that will play out. So yeah, you're absolutely right. I think whether it's talking to the investment community who are looking at listed shares, whether it's looking at, you know, your potential angel or VC or PE type backers, or whether it's just pitching internally to your CFO or FD or CEO for funding within the business, I think it's the same key message that you'd like to get across as to why you want to do it, how you're going to execute on it, and therefore what you need, and then what are the results. And ultimately, we're all in a results-driven business, whichever business we're in. So executing on it is, you know, you've got a metric that you're going to hit or need to hit, which is the numbers. But ultimately, if you don't believe in the bigger picture, the ability of that individual to manage the team to hit those numbers, it's harder to invest into that department, say, versus another. But you're right, it's definitely the same model that I would use internally as well.
So some tips for the team potentially for persuading you with a business case.
If they're listening, then yes, definitely.
Because I find that fascinating as well, is that because it's very easy, it's reminiscent of the pyramid principle, which that McKinsey are famous for, which, you know, lead with your conclusion and then your supporting evidence, and then you can talk about the data that sits within each piece of that, and you build it in reverse. And I think that some of it comes down to the way that you're thinking. So in your case, you're clearly someone who likes the big picture first, and then you can dive into the details. Our CEO, our founder, he's very much of an engineering mindset. And so his way of thinking is like to look at the component parts and build the way up. And so one thing that I've noticed is that they need to judge quite quickly the audience and how they're thinking about things, and then switch it potentially on that basis. It's very hard to do if you're building, say, if you've got a pre prepared, say, analyst presentation or company presentation, but is that something that you also try and build into the way that you'll tell those narratives and those stories, is like reading the audience and then adjusting accordingly?
Oh, absolutely. Because when meeting with investors today, for example, when we're a management team, but also compare that to when meeting investors as an analyst, the audience definitely needs different things. So you prepare for all eventualities. So I talk about the big picture and putting that first, et cetera. But there are cases where you have to have a detailed bottom-up view as well. But you put that first because they want to go straight into the weeds rather than because someone may believe they understand the industry, understand the dynamics. But also, you know, when you're presenting to people, whether it be twice a year or more often, you've probably gone through that big picture a number of times in the past. So at that point, the big picture becomes less important unless there's been a substantial change. And therefore, you're now presenting an update on the detail. So we, for example, as a business, you can say we were looking to invest X into region Y, and that was a year ago. This is now the results of that investment. Very simple case. And that's, I think, with everything. So you do, when we're meeting with people first up, completely fresh, usually they do want that big picture context. Because it's interesting, actually. The first question you get asked when you're meeting someone completely new, and that was whether I was as an analyst explaining companies or today as CFO of .digital when we're on investment roadshows, the first question you get asked is, can you give me the 2-minute background on the business, where you've come from, and where you're going to? So I think most people want that context. They want to understand top down what it is you're doing, where you have come from, what you're looking to achieve, and then go into the detail of how you're going to achieve it. So I think even if you're talking to an engineer or an accountant who wants to go into all that level of detail, I still think contextualizing it, even if it's brief, it gives the story better light, because you could just go straight into, we are, you know, just take .digital. We're a SaaS model. We generate 20% plus return on top line with a 20% plus operating margin. Now, that's given you some financial metrics, but it hasn't really told you a huge amount about what the business does, how it's evolved, what level of investment's been needed, what the plan is. There's no sort of way of contextualizing that beyond comparing that to other financial metrics of other businesses and saying, well, they grow 20%, they grow 10, they grow 30, they're doing a margin of X, they're doing a margin of Y. But, and that's fine, because everyone looks at valuation multiples and comparables and all those tables and charts to see what could look interesting. But for me, if I'm investing, say, my personal money into a business, I want to know, what does that company do? Where is it going? What is the background of the management team? And why is it I believe they'll be successful? What is it they have that others may not? So if you're investing your personal wealth that way, and I'd assume most people do, rather than purely just off some kind of valuation table, wouldn't you want the story explained in that way? So I think it's always worth contextualizing what you're looking to achieve. And that's not just on the business. It could be anything. As you mentioned, internally, when you're pitching to, it could be pitching to other departments. It could be trying to help as a business partner to other departments. It's always worth contextualizing what you're trying to achieve first. And that, to me, is good communication, so that you can then follow that up with the detail to say, look, this is what we're trying to achieve, and this is how we think we can help you, or we can work together to achieve it. And that, to me, goes down a lot better than starting with your numbers say XYZ, that says this. That's great. I mean, that's insight, but to me, that's not doing it in the right way to contextualize.
And I'd love to go back to something that you mentioned earlier on, which is the idea of the .digital and the board, and part of the reason that you decided to join was that they wanted to move beyond purely accounting. Now, of course, accounting is an important part of what's there, but I read a quote from you which said that they were looking for someone who's more of an analyst and not just an accountant, so that they had to have complementary skills. And so then with that in mind, that touches on a theme that comes up time and time again, which is the idea of the evolving role of a CFO. In the past, it might have been restricted to more of an accountant and someone focused on that side of things, the reporting aspect. And more, it's moving towards a far broader, more expansive reach that touches on all facets of the company. And so it seems as if that's something that Dot Digital recognized and when they were commencing the search and you started to have conversations with them. Is that something that you have seen in your role or you saw beforehand? Or is it just a coincidence that, you know, that you met up with Dot Digital and that this is actually where you've ended up?
So to be fair to the board, I think they were proactively looking that way. I think Milan was also looking that way because Milan himself was the CFO before, is an accountant by trade. My FD, George, is an accountant. We have my financial controller, Joao, another accountant. And then at the time, all three of the board members were accountants themselves as well. So this is what I mean by we were very accounting heavy. But a lot of accountants' skill set is looking at reported numbers, looking at what's happened and reporting those numbers. It's not necessarily translating those numbers into what can happen. And I'm not talking about next month or next quarter. I'm talking about 3 to 5 years out. That's much more of an analyst skill set of, I can see these trends. These are the bigger picture elements that are taking place within the industry, putting that all together, translating that into 3 and 5 year forecasts. So they were proactively looking at someone who could help with the forward looking element of it. When I say they, I mean the board at the time. But more importantly, it was the fact that the CFO in any business, and definitely the case for myself, we have access to pretty much all of the data that sits within the organization, whether that be the CRM information, of course, your accounting platform and everything that sits for us within Sage, plus any sort of customer data for us that sits in our customer platform. But all of the data that sits within the business, I have access to. There isn't really most businesses of let's say mid-size, of our size and smaller, and even some larger, probably do not have one person or team sat there just analyzing the data and just saying, what does this data mean? Because it's not cheap to hire. And these aren't data scientists, but these are effectively analysts, right, ultimately. So I suppose the thinking from the board as well, why don't just bring in an analyst who can also help with the city and the investment community, who can also help the business to translate a lot of this data into tangible, actionable ideas that we can work off to understand what's happening. And also, to some extent, you come in with a sort of fresh pair of eyes and you look at a lot of the processes and you try and improve them. So a lot of what my role has been is, of course, we have to get the annual reports out and the results and that side. But a lot of it has been helping to optimize a lot of the internal processes that we've had within the finance function, but also the wider business. So that digital transformation that everyone talks about, that is, I think, a large part of the modern CFO's role, because you have a lot of information metrics about how different departments are performing, what's working, what's not, where time could be better spent. You have a lot of these ROI metrics from within your business as well. Add to that the amount of data you might get from your CRM showing efficiencies and whatever it is that you're measuring. Plus, then you've got all your financial information. And that financial data, of course, looks back at the previous month, quarter, year, etc. You can take all of that and then begin to look at, okay, what's working, what's not? Where should we be investing? What do we need to change? What's not working? What can we do to improve? What can we do to help people improve? So you have a lot of power if you choose to look at it that way. Others, I suppose a traditional CFO may just say, my job is to report what's happened. And it's someone else's job, CEO or someone else, to look at what can you do going forward to change it if things need to change. So in that way, as I say, I think the board is very forward thinking. A lot of companies now do have that more operational CFO, let's say. But underlying that is very much a data-driven decision maker, just to a large extent, to help the entire business to optimize. And I think that's, for me, the key. Can you get every department to drive a higher ROI? And if you can do that as a CFO, I think that's far more valuable than, well, my revenue last month was X, my profit was Y, and that's in line with what the business needs. I mean, that's great, but that doesn't give you anything to actually action on. Whereas if you're looking at the information and saying, well, look, our pipe for next month is saying X and this department's ROI looks to be dropping a little bit. Okay, what did we change? Why is that happening? speak to those departments and then look at some of those metrics that people measure themselves on and say, are they the right metrics? Do they need to change? Have things changed? That, to me, is a lot more valuable for the business. And so keeping on top of looking ahead, which sounds obvious, but is probably one of the hardest things to do, I think is definitely part of the role of today's more modern CFO role, especially in larger organizations. So the bigger that company gets, you can have a CFO and an FD, and you can have, you know, an accounts team much more focused on the reporting side of things. And then actually as the CFO, you can take much more responsibility for that looking ahead piece, looking at where you should be investing, looking at what the best use of OPEX is, plus CAPEX, plus making sure that you're, from a public company point of view, hitting your numbers. And even, I suppose, as a private company, you're still going to have to hit certain metrics for your backers. So ultimately, yeah, the role of the CFO, I think, has definitely changed a lot over the last 3 or 4 years. I think our previous board was very proactive in looking at that. And thankfully, that worked out well for us.
I can actually appreciate the working together with the analyst group that you mentioned. So in various previous roles, worked very closely with the FP&A analysts that have worked as business partners across the organization. And they can be so incredibly powerful because they provide a truth and a certainty, because whenever finance says something, you're like, okay, there's a certain threshold of what we do, even within analysis, which is sometimes, of course, not on the same level as reporting. But when you have that gravitas bringing to the table, but to other problems outside of the reporting arena, it can be immensely powerful, which is where I'd imagine that the analyst becomes very much a business partner, which goes far beyond, as you would describe it, the strength in accountancy that you would have had at the very beginning.
Yeah, and I think if I could get all of the accountants in my team to be forward-looking and to anticipate what may happen, that would be the optimal position. Because, as I said, it's very easy to look backwards and to report on what's happened and to show lots of pretty pictures and graphs and charts to say, well, we've come from here and we're now here and we've gone. But actually, can someone extrapolate that to, well, we're here today, we need to get to X tomorrow, we're currently trending towards Y, how do we make the delta? Now, that is the hardest thing for any business, because change is not easy at the best of times. Change when you know you have to change, but you're not sure what to change, is even harder, because then you're trying different things and you may not have the capacity to do that. So if you can preempt areas of weakness, particularly before they happen, that's the ultimate sort of holy grail of, in my view anyway, of analysis and what you're looking to achieve. And if you can be better than what you thought, fantastic. That's just icing on the cake. So it's identifying those potential weaknesses before they become a weakness that, for me, is the biggest challenge and what we look for. And if you can do that and try and fix a problem almost before it happens, you're in a very strong position. So for us, touch wood, there's not too many problems as such that we've had to fix, but there are always certain things, right? Even if you're in your entire business, everything's going swimmingly well, you could always have some macro factor that comes in and kicks things out of left field. And you're then looking at, okay, what do we have to do? And COVID was one of those. You know, the pandemic has impacted every business in some way, shape or form. Fortunately for us, it's not been too big an impact, but at the beginning, there was that uncertainty. So you're always going to have to deal with uncertainties and things going slightly off the straight line when you're looking at how things will trend. But if you can preempt and deal with those faster than your competitors, faster than others, then you'll be in a stronger position. And I think that's the key. It's, you've got to measure yourself against not just yourself, but also your peer group, because ultimately, in any business, that's what you're competing against.
And that is a very interesting concept, because it's not just about arriving at a decision, say, as a group within your company, within your team. But if, as you said, if you can do that faster than peers, than competitors, you can have and you can do that sustainably, consistently, you can have a competitive advantage. And so that's a It's a very interesting concept. And I wonder, you mentioned COVID. I mean, it's hard to have any conversation about looking into the future without talking about COVID. And I'd imagine your forecasting in this time last year was maybe more challenging than this year, thankfully. But of course, you're part of the Bank of England decision-making panel that's looking at the effect of, say, Brexit and COVID on the economy. I'd imagine, of course, focused on the UK. So maybe to put your forward-looking skills to the test, could you speak a little bit about how you see the reopening of the economy, whether that's, of course, in part in the UK down to Brexit, or whether, of course, it's worldwide and down to COVID? Because I think that's very much on the forefront, and I'm sure it's on yours too, the forefront of all financial leaders and all senior executives, is looking for the green shoots of recovery so that they can take advantage of those opportunities.
You're absolutely right. This time last year, when modelling out the year ahead, was quite challenging. But to be fair, we were quite prudent, and that's probably helped us in that the areas that we thought we wouldn't be spending at all on, and that would be things like travel, we budgeted for some recovery in the second half, which then gives you a bit of fat when looking at the numbers, because you're going to underspend versus your forecast, which is no bad thing necessarily. Offices reopening, again, I mean, IFRS 16 helps from a P&L perspective, in that a lot of those office costs are no longer on your P&L. You're just capitalizing. So that helps a little bit. But ultimately, there are other associated costs that do impact your P&L that sit alongside the reopening of offices. And that was a difficult one to forecast, because this time last year, everyone was hoping that by, let's say, before Christmas, things would be open again. And they weren't. So again, that helps when you're forecasting and you're putting this in. But ultimately, you're potentially overspending on areas which you could have reinvested back into marketing and others. And we are fortunately flexible enough where we then did put more back into marketing and sales through the course of the year, because we have that flexible operating model. Looking ahead, to your point, I think there's a few factors that you have to consider. So look, everyone's still talking June 21st. We could just be fully open. Nightclubs open and the UK just be back to normal. But I think the thing people forget is the emotional side of things. Because let's say if things open up fully and nightclubs are open, and we're talking about now 50% plus of the country has had at least one vaccine, and I think probably another 20% or so have had both. Does that mean emotionally people just feel they can just go out and do whatever and mix and forget about social distancing, not worry about if you catch it, are you still infectious to others or not? Or so I think there's still going to be that emotional element for people to overcome around, firstly, just mixing with other people, because I don't remember the last time I've ever been in a social scenario with more than six people. It's been a long time. But also, you've got a large percentage of people who have got used to this kind of, we're working from home. We're not doing a huge amount of socializing beyond meeting a couple of people here and there, usually outside. It's summer. It's nice. You can meet outside. So I think, to answer your question, I think it will take longer for things to open up fully, to be fully utilized. So clubs can be open, restaurants can be open, bars can be open, other forms of entertainment, whether it be cinemas and whatever, are all open. But actually, to get to the utilization rates that we had prior to the pandemic beginning, I'm not sure that happens in at least a six-month period, assuming June 21st, everything opens up in the UK. So let's say 2022, we could start to get close to those utilization levels, because there's a six-month period, people see positive news flow, the hospitalizations aren't increasing, deaths aren't increasing, etc. So 2022, and that's the UK. Now you look at the rest of the world. When do we actually go on holiday? When does the rest of the world open up? Well, a lot of it comes down to vaccination programs, those countries having the confidence that they can open up. We as a country being confident that we can send people to other countries and then come back and not, there's no issue. That to me takes a lot longer. So I'm not expecting a huge amount of international travel for, let's say, more than what we've seen in the last year for most of next year. I think 2023 would be when you begin to see that start to return back to normal levels, because you've got the vaccination programs across the world that should have kicked in by that point. But I think I read the stat this morning, because we have an office in Melbourne and a couple of offices in Australia. So the state of Victoria is back into lockdown, Melbourne in particular, because they've had 6 cases last week or something and 60 cases overall, which compare that to the UK and we'd be in lockdown permanently if that were the case. But they've obviously locked down their borders. And so they've only got I don't know if the number was right, but it's a couple of percent of the population so far has been vaccinated. So you've got sort of Western countries, obviously not geographically, but in terms of the economy, still not having large scale vaccination programs that have taken place. So I think the UK and the US are the most ahead. But there's a lot of countries where that hasn't happened. It's taking a lot longer. It's a lot slower. So I think for international travel to resume, and I don't think it ever gets back to the levels it was, because we've all got comfortable with virtual meetings and video calls, and we've become more productive because I'm having a lot more conversations with our US and Australian colleagues today, because we can do this at any time from home. You're more comfortable doing it versus, do I want to do a conference call at midnight from the office? Not really. Whereas from home, you're a bit more forgiving. So yeah, I think the world will begin to open up over the next 18 months, but slowly. And it's going to take longer than I think people expect. It can't just go back to how it was immediately.
And within that depiction is that you're also touching on the fact that Dot Digital has such a global team. So you're active in many different markets. And you mentioned Australia has been one of those. And so now that your workforce is largely remote or to some degree potentially hybrid, but of course that can help with the way that you engage, to your point, like the remote teams, the teams are in far-flung regions. But I'd imagine it might complicate your growth strategy when you're thinking about which markets to open up or to invest further in because of this uncertainty. Is that something, again, if you're thinking about investment plans, without going into necessarily specifics, but is that something that has complicated your international expansion?
So as a business, we've kind of come to the conclusion that we will move to a much more flexi working model going forward. So I don't envisage more than, I'd say, somewhere between 5 and 20% of the workforce being full-time office-based. It could be at a lower end, to be fair, for those roles that really have to be office-based. But otherwise, it would be very flexible. So we operate in, obviously, I've mentioned the US and Australia, but we've got offices in South Africa, we've got Poland, Belarus, we've got the Netherlands, Singapore. So we're already operating in a lot of regions where that flexi working was already in place, where we don't necessarily have everyone in offices or certain teams wouldn't work in offices and they'd be fully remote already. So when we're looking at new territories, and you know, I can say that we're looking at probably 2 or 3 new territories in terms of expansion this year, or next financial year rather, we would probably look at hiring people remote first anyway, because it's part of the culture as we've done that in the first place. So we want local presence, but we're happy for them to be remote and not need an office. I think offices, really, once you start to get to maybe 30, 40 people, then you might need some location where people can actually meet. But when you're talking about 2, 3, 4, in our experience, it's not been as necessary. And the pandemic's shown that people can work more efficiently, to be honest, in a lot of cases, working from home and being more flexible than having to go into a fixed office every day. So it hasn't hurt us in that sense or hindered us. But the challenge is you can't meet people face to face before you hire them. So of all the people that we've hired over the last 12 months, to be fair, I've never met any of them face to face. And their hiring manager has probably not, well, I know in finance, for example, I've not met a lot of those team members we've hired in the last 12 months, and the hiring managers won't have met those people. And some of them they've come and gone in some cases. But you know that it's tougher in that sense. But I have good faith in our sort of recruitment team's methodology and how we operate. And we've made a lot of good hires. And we were kind of used to making hires in remote territories, but we always had someone on the ground that they could meet. But now, you know, we've hired more people in the likes of South Africa and Poland recently, but we've just not been able to get out there to actually meet them face to face. But we're used to that kind of online onboarding of new staff. So it's been okay. But that's probably the biggest challenge, I think, that COVID presents when you just haven't met people in your team for a year who joined face-to-face. But video calls and things help. I think if this pandemic was 20 years ago, the world would struggle significantly without video conferencing technology, without the speed of the internet we have today and all the other ability that gives us that ability to work from home, the technology that's happened. Whereas if this was, you know, when I'd first started, for example, in the city, I think life would be very difficult if there was these kinds of lockdowns. So thankfully, the saving grace to some extent is this happened now and not 20 years ago.
Yeah, and we're talking on a business level, but on a personal level, that would be as true as ever with, you know, children, grandparents and so on. It has come at a time where we've perhaps been as prepared as we ever could be to maintain that connection despite the distance. The other theme that I wanted to touch on with you is one that you mentioned recently on a webcast that you were on. And it was the point where, so you have this remote team and you're building that and you're scaling that. And of course, the finance team is one that you were transforming to complement the strength it had in accountancy to add in that analytical analyst type mentality. And so the point that you raised on the webinar itself was around the importance or the power of the digitization, but particularly the automation. That automation can actually, rather than be something that, you know, streamlines it and means that you either don't need to hire or you can have a trimmer team, it actually means you can refocus the team, abstract the team into higher order activities. Could you speak a little bit about your point of view on that with automation? Because again, it is an increasing theme, well, like for every business, but I think it's emerging rapidly in the finance department and in the minds of every CFO.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, look, there's a lot of different options out there in order to how you could potentially automate a lot of processes, right? Starting from AP to expenses to AR to a large extent, credit control. There's a number of things you could automate quite quickly with robotic process automation and other forms of technology that's there. You could do it to cost cut, absolutely. But the way I see it is rather than doing it to purely cut costs, I've always believed in upskilling people, giving people that opportunity. You know, I joined when I first started at Goldman Sachs as a graduate and spent 2 years working all sorts of hours, but learning my trade. And if I wasn't given that opportunity, I wouldn't be where I am today. And so the way I see it is when you bring people into a business, into an organization, it's your responsibility as the manager, as the business, to make sure that person continues to grow, to learn more, to become more valuable, not just to the business, but to themselves to a large extent. Because if you can let people come up through the business, and you know, Milan, as our CEO, is a classic example. He started off as, I think, was sort of in the top 15 or first one of the first 15 or 20 employees we had as a business. He's come all the way through from where he started to being the CEO. So ours is an organization where we do try and help people to progress through the business. We've got a number of people who've been with the company 5, 10 plus years. And so if you can automate the manual processes that just take time but aren't really adding value, to then allow your team to learn more around that forecasting, learn around looking at the data, what does it mean, interacting more with other parts of the business and growing as a person, as a employee, and helping the business but themselves feeling like they're doing more value add, ultimately that works in everyone's favor. So you could then potentially automate processes and hire in expensive people who've already done the role, who know. But I think that satisfaction that comes from seeing a sort of a younger person or a more junior role grow and become more proficient in their role, learn the business, understand the business. And what you'd hope for, and this is the key to it, is you get much more back from them. You're going to have people who are more wedded to the business, who are more just happier in what they're doing day to day, but they will be far more open to growing within that business than if you bring someone in who's probably got their own style, they've learned from somewhere else, and they're less flexible is what I've seen historically. Yes, you sometimes do need to add talent from outside, but you get the commitment, you get that level of feeling, I suppose. It's an intangible to some extent where people just feel you've helped them out and therefore they're stickier ultimately. They're less likely to want to walk away, and you as a manager also feel you're helping people. So it's a symbiotic win-win relationship if you can help people to move away from doing the manual stuff. And absolutely, I think all finance functions should automate a lot of that basic functionality, because why wouldn't you? And then that gives you the opportunity for your team to be doing far more interesting, progressive, value-add work that can help the business in a much better way. And ultimately, that, in my opinion anyway, is what the business should be looking at.
Which is a very interesting concept, because then you're using automation rather than to cut costs or to increase time to market, which is often, these are things that are mentioned. You're using it in a way to drive employee engagement and opportunity and that retention of your team, which of course is another existential challenge, but again, not one that's often associated with finance. It's more perhaps the people team or CEO. But I think that probably that's another nod to the expanding scope and remit of a CFO in today's world.
Absolutely. I think getting commitment from your team, getting buy-in to your vision, the company's vision, you need it from all departments. It can't just be sales and marketing and in HR that buy into it. It's got to be finance and legal and operations and other parts of the business that also understand where the business is going and how they play a part. Because every single person within the business is a component that plays a part in the success of the business. Unless that individual understands that or is shown how that's the case, and it gives them a sense of responsibility, you're not going to have everyone working optimally to the benefit of the business. So absolutely, you want to empower people to make them feel that they are playing a part in the growth of the business. It's not just the salespeople who have a revenue number on their head. Every single role is important. And the more you can upskill that role and make that role something that people can see the value add easily, it becomes easier to manage, and absolutely employee satisfaction, employee commitment to the business and ultimately the happiness of the overall business and your culture. That's where it stems from. And that's what we look to do at .digital. It's great when it works, because you see people coming through, going all the way from the lowest rung right to the top. And that's possible. And that shows people the opportunity that's there if they want to take it. And they're given that opportunity. So it means doors are open. And I think for me, that's always the hardest challenge in any organization, where you have every organization has a pyramid structure, and people often feel the only way a door opens is if someone above moves. But you can't have that as your opening, because that creates politics. That creates a culture of, I need to show I'm better than my manager and therefore I can take my manager's job. That's the wrong culture. You need people to feel that there's opportunity for them to do more in their current roles. Plus, if they were to go up a role, it's not determined by whether there's someone else sitting in that job. It's about the value that you're adding in your role to the business. And therefore, every role plays a key part in some way, shape, or form. And if everyone feels that, I think you get a much better culture and a much better level of employee satisfaction.
And with that in mind, many of our listeners will be people who are aspiring CFOs. They would like to move and progress their career into that direction. What advice would you give to those people, given the context of what the type of finance function that you're building and your perspective on that and the evolving role of the CFO? What advice would you give to those people who are slightly earlier in their careers but have got big aspirations?
Again, probably a few key things. The first is, look, ultimately as a CFO, you do need to know your numbers. And that doesn't just mean your financial figures, your P&L, balance sheet, cash flow. That just means you've got to be comfortable with data. Because the more comfortable you are with data to understand how you can use data, what data is relevant, what data is not. So you've got to have that level of comfort. The second is, I would say, work on communication skills. Because whilst traditional CFOs, you report on numbers, communication probably wasn't seen as a most necessary skill set. I think that's definitely changed, where you need to be able to communicate not just to your teams, but to the wider lead, whether it be a leadership team in your organization, but to all other departments. You know, I probably spend 70% of my time talking to other departments than I do talking to my department, because they lean on me for a lot of information and just conversation around certain things. But ultimately, because you need to have a big picture of what's happening across the entire business. And I think the third part is, beyond sort of numbers and communication, is whatever industry you're in, whatever company you're looking to work for, make sure you know that as well as you can. Because you can go and work for any company and then try and learn it and understand what they're doing, etc. But it's far easier if you've got a knowledge base of the business, its competitors, the industry they're in, to be able to then add value straight away. Because no CFO walking into the role day one will know the numbers inside out. It's not possible. But you can know the industry, you can know the market. So a little bit of what I was saying at the outset, if you know the industry and you're able to articulate what it is you're looking to achieve and looking to do, then you can get to grips with the numbers to see what is it that you need, what gaps need to be closed, what is it that's working, what is it that's not, to eventually get there. So if you know your industry and you know your targets, bigger picture, at least that gives you a head start. Whereas if you're coming into any company fresh, you won't know the numbers, because ultimately it's not a business you'll have worked in, and everything you're going to have to pick up. So it's good to have some prior knowledge of, you know, it's one of those things when we interview candidates, we'll just ask them a very simple question around the industry just to see if they've done their homework. Because if you've shown no interest in the industry or the company, yes, you can do your job, but ultimately, are you going to be successful at doing your job in the way the business wants? Probably not. Not always the case, but probably not.
It should be the easiest research to do, because it's the one that's very obvious often to find. But I think that's very, very sage advice. Barak, I want to thank you for your time, for coming on the show. There's been some fascinating insights. If anyone that was listening wanted to connect with you, where could they go and either follow or connect with you?
LinkedIn is probably the easiest one. I'm on there. But otherwise, you know, being a publicly listed company, my email address is probably in our annual report as well. But LinkedIn would be the first and foremost place to go to, and happy to connect with anyone who would like to. But no, thank you, Ross, for your time as well. It's been a great discussion.
Great. Thank you very much, Barak. Thank you for listening. And if you're enjoying the podcast, it would mean a lot if you leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or share it with someone that you think would enjoy it. CFO Playbook is brought to you by Soldo, the number one corporate card and spend management platform. Learn more at soldo.com.